Hello, everyone. From Glenmont Partners from Nuveen, this is Glenmont's Insights. Here we discuss all things energy transition, from policy to technology. With assets in multiple geographies and nearly 4 billion assets under management, we are one of the largest fund managers focusing exclusively on investments in clean energy infrastructure. To find out more about us, visit www.glenmont.com. Welcome to episode 6 of Glenmont Insights. I'm your host, Dries Bruland, head of US at Glenmont Partners from Nuveen. And today we will talk about a topic which is on everybody's mind in renewables, i.e. the status of the supply chain in the US and the impact of the IRA. Who better to discuss this topic with than Oliver Kerr? Oliver is the head of North America of Aurora Energy Research, an energy research company providing market-leading forecasts and data-driven intelligence for the global energy transition. Oliver, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, Dries. It's really good to be here.
Okay, well, let's kick off with a high-level overview of the IRA. Can you please describe the main features of the IRA across the different policy areas? Also, why the IRA issued guidance on some topics? More guidance is expected in Q4 of this year. Can you please elaborate on timing and remaining uncertainties, Oliver?
Sure, I'll do my best to summarize. But first off, look, I want to be really clear about the scale of the challenge the IRA is trying to address. So the Biden administration has set really ambitious targets for decarbonization in the United States. There's the goal of reaching net zero emissions in the power sector by 2035 and economy-wide by 2050. Now, that will be hard enough if all we were talking about was reducing the emissions associated with today's level of electricity consumption to zero. Sadly, that's not the case. You know, we expect power demand to increase by nearly 50% by 2050, driven by a combination of population growth, further electrification, and so on. So that's the context in which we have the Inflation Reduction Act, perhaps the most significant piece of energy and industrial policy ever passed in the United States. And before we get to the detail, I think it's important to point out just the sheer quantum of clean energy spending in the bill is enormous. So White House estimates put the total at $370 billion. Arguably, that's on the low side. Actual spending is uncapped. It really depends on how successful the act is in spurring new clean tech deployment. Some estimates put spending closer to $1 trillion over the next 10 years. So look, the IRA is huge. It's also comprehensive. So it has support for everything from upstream manufacturing to deployment. In many ways, really a textbook example of industrial policy. So what's actually in it? Well, without going into all the detail, which should probably take a couple more episodes of the podcast in itself, the main policy mechanism in the IRA across different technologies, different parts of the value chain, is tax credits. So there are now tax credits for wind, solar, battery, manufacturing and deployment, for EV manufacturing and sales, for hydrogen, even support for things like battery recycling. So all of these are really expected to ramp up the pace of clean tech deployment in the United States. Having said that, as you mentioned in the question, the devil really is in the detail. So the Treasury and the IRS are working as fast as they can to clarify exactly how different projects will be eligible for tax credits. But there's still quite a lot of uncertainty. So for instance, we're still waiting on final guidance for things like 45X, that's the Advanced Manufacturing Tax Credit, for guidance on exactly what the rules will be around green energy matching for hydrogen at the hourly level, you know, exactly how transferability of tax credits will work, and so on. You know, the bill passed it a year ago now, but it likely won't be till the end of the year before all of the rules are finally hammered out.
Okay, thank you. Interesting. Let's focus more on the supply chain now. An estimated $65 billion has been invested into new clean energy manufacturing facilities since signing of the IRA. How much of the current U.S. clean tech demand is met domestically, and where and in which technologies are main investments taking place?
Yeah, good question. So right now, relatively little clean tech demand is met locally. So if we take solar as an example, I think the US now produces around 5 gigawatts of solar each year. Most of that is thin film, which is primarily for residential behind the meter applications rather than grid scale. To date, none of that would meet the requirements in the IRA to qualify for the domestic content bonus. A lot of the parts are still manufactured abroad and then assembled here in the US. Similar story in batteries. You know, as such, the US is fairly reliant on international supply chains, which are really struggling to keep pace with demand right now. Look, I think the phrase supply chain issues is sometimes bandied about as a bit of a catch-all term. Just to be clear about what we mean, I think people often use it to refer to three different but quite related things. So there's the soaring cost of the raw materials themselves needed for clean tech production. There's the challenges of ramping up sufficient manufacturing capacity. And then there's the challenges of building sufficient logistics and installation capacity. So things like having skilled labor, having EPC capacity, even things like the boats you need to install offshore wind, you know, all of these are struggling to keep pace with demand right now. If you add to that then the broader inflationary environment, higher labor costs, rising interest rates that jack up the cost of debt, I think we've seen something of a perfect storm driving up the cost of renewables projects over the last year or so. And it's already taking a toll, right? So just in the last couple of weeks, we've seen some big announcements in Massachusetts, in Rhode Island, in the UK, where offshore wind projects have fallen through, primarily as a result of cost increases. You know, in some ways, the IRA threatens to make things worse insofar as it, you know, massively increases demand for wind and solar and batteries. Having said that, I think the beauty of the IRA is that it isn't just a policy that focuses on the demand side by supporting clean tech deployment. It really is, like I said upfront, a full-on industrial policy to support the whole clean tech value chain. So starting with supply-side policies for clean tech manufacturing. And the signs so far have been really encouraging. So since the IRA was passed last August, we've seen around $65 billion of investment announced for clean energy manufacturing. You know, where's that going? Well, about three quarters of that, around $50 billion, is for battery manufacturing. So both for EVs and for utility scale uses. Around $10 billion is for EVs directly, and around $5 billion for solar. So in total, around 100 manufacturing facilities have been announced since last year. Many of them in the Southeast, in states like Georgia, the Carolinas, Atlanta, an area some are starting to call the U.S. battery belt. And I think one of the really big things to watch is how this plays out, you know, geographically. Interestingly, and you know, I think in many ways, by design almost, I expect we'll see a lot of the benefits of the IRA accruing to red states that generally have a business-friendly environment. It's certainly what we've seen so far.
Interesting. So certainly a lot of investments taking place. Let's move on to the next question. How does the manufacturing tax credit work and which components are eligible? How can developers capture that domestic content adders? And is there any difference between solar, onshore, and offshore wind?
Okay, so this can get fairly complicated fairly quickly. So I'll try to break it down as simply as I can. The important thing to remember here is that there are basically two types of credits on offer. So there's what you might call supply push type credits that focus on domestic manufacturing of clean tech. And then there are what you might call demand pull credits to support project developers that actually buy and install domestic products. Where it can start to get a bit confusing is that in each case, in general, you can choose between taking the subsidy either in the form of an investment tax credit, basically a credit that's paid as a percentage of your upfront investment costs, or as a production tax credit, which is paid out per unit of product produced. So to start on the manufacturing side, you have a choice between 48C, which is a 6% investment tax credit for investing in clean tech manufacturing. That rises to 30% if the project meets certain labor standards, to 40% for projects in certain communities where coal mines or plants have been closing down. So that's the ITC on the manufacturing side. The other option is 45X, which is paid out at different rates for components that go into solar panels and batteries. So, you know, there are different rates for the wafers for the, you know, in different parts of the inverter and so on. And that's the production tax credit. It's a similar story on the deployment side. So developers can choose between the ITC and the PTC to subsidize either upfront investment costs in wind, solar batteries, or the cost per megawatt hour of power generated. In both cases, there's an additional bonus, as you mentioned, for domestic content. Exactly what counts as domestic content to qualify for the extra bump is complicated, but essentially all of the construction materials, that basically refers to anything that's fundamental to the structural integrity of the thing that's being produced. So I think the bill actually describes it as if you didn't have this thing, it would fall down. So things like steel needed to make wind farms. So all of those construction materials 100% need to be sourced within the US. They can't be imported. And then on top of that, at least 40% of all of the manufactured parts that go into the product need to be made in the US. And that rises over time to 55% by 2028. So in other words, you can't just source all your materials elsewhere, assemble them in the US, and then qualify for the tax credit. The goal here really is to support domestic industry from start to finish.
Got it. And is there actually a difference between solar and onshore and offshore wind?
Yeah, it's a little bit lower for offshore wind than other technologies in the short term. By lower, I mean the requirements are a little bit lower. So I think they start at 20% of manufactured products in offshore wind. And that's primarily to reflect the fact that in the offshore space, local supply chains are relatively limited to date, but that ramps up to the same as onshore wind and solar by 2028, the 55%.
Okay, got it. So, and then... will U.S. domestic supply be competitive with international markets? And does the same conclusion apply to solar as well as wind?
Yeah, look, there's really no getting away from the fact that it's cheaper to produce wind turbines and solar panels abroad than it is in the U.S. And that's obviously not unique to wind and solar. It applies to all sorts of things. Having said that, the tax credits in the IRA really do have the potential to make domestic supply competitive with international markets. So in other words, I do think it's possible that increased labor costs in the US are offset by tax credits for both manufacturing and deployment. So our analysis finds that if developers are able to capture 90% of the value of the tax credits, that is a big assumption that we can come to, domestic wind and solar could be around 15% cheaper than imports from other markets. I do think it's interesting, historically, there's been something of a consensus across the political spectrum in the US that globalization is generally a good thing. You know, then we've had COVID, we've had a clean energy crisis in Europe, we've had a general push on the right to reduce reliance on China and from the left to support domestic labor. So to me, the IRA, you know, its focus on labor standards, its focus on domestic manufacturing, really does strike me as more evidence of this broader retreat from globalization as the underlying principle behind international trade and free markets.
Okay. And would the same count for wind as well?
Yes. I think that it's very similar reductions in wind and solar across them. So in general, I think it's for both technologies, we found that with all of the tax credits in the IRA, in both cases, the domestic supply could be up to around 15% cheaper than imports. Again, it depends on exactly what you assume for how much of the credits end up in the pocket of people actually investing in and deploying these assets.
Okay, got it. Thank you. Moving on to the U.S. solar module market now, Can you paint us a picture of the U.S. solar market and how supply will evolve versus demand? What percentage do you expect to qualify for the domestic content adder? And which factors will impact realization of the domestic content requirements?
So solar is really booming in the U.S. right now. And we're really only just beginning. So look, today there's around 80 gigawatts, 80, of solar installed in the United States. We see that increasing around fivefold in our forecasts by 2035. That's huge. That's the equivalent of installing around 20 gigawatts of solar a year, around a quarter of today's capacity every year for the next 12 years. You know, it's a huge, huge deployment of solar across the board. The question is how much of that demand could be met locally and actually qualify for the domestic content bonus. So in the short term, the answer is definitely not enough. Our modeling shows that across the U.S., we expect around 15 to 20 gigawatts of solar to be deployed annually for the next couple of years. Right now, total U.S. solar manufacturing capacity is around 9 gigawatts, but none of that would actually qualify for the domestic content adder since too many of the parts are produced abroad. In the long term, we do really see that changing as new manufacturing capacity comes online. So by 2026, 2027, we think that domestic supply will be able to satisfy U.S. demand and qualify for the domestic content bonus. There's still a lot of uncertainty around exactly how fast demand will grow, how U.S. companies can shore up the supply of raw materials, to what extent we can train the local workforce. But in general, our outlook is fairly optimistic for local supply chains being able to ramp up by the late 2020s.
Got it. And are there actually any other factors you see that will impact the realization of these domestic content requirements?
Yeah. So I think, like I said, growing U.S. demand, exactly how fast demand for U.S. solar ramps up will matter. If it grows more quickly than we expect in our central case, that could stress supply chains much further. Like I say, domestic manufacturers have to shore up supply of raw materials and upstream supply. So things like ingot, wafer, and cell manufacturing facilities are getting a lot less investment than the actual modules. New mines are hard to build in the United States. Nobody wants a mine nearby. The U.S. only controls around 3.6% of global lithium capacity. And again, things like lack of skilled workforce may be a challenge. Certainly, the U.S. lags a little bit in things like R&D. So that will need to ramp up to keep pace with demand.
Okay, thank you. One of the other challenges of the IRA has to do with pass-through rates, i.e. how much of the tax credit value is captured by the developers. What is the effect of lower pass-through rates on the total installed renewables capacity in the U.S.? And does this vary by ISO?
Yeah, I do think this is an important point. So, just because U.S. manufacturers can get a 30% tax credit, doesn't mean all of those savings will be passed on to buyers of solar panels or batteries. This is especially true in the short term when demand for domestic manufactured equipment outstrips supply. It's likely that we'll see domestic manufacturers pricing up to international markets. And it's the same when it comes to actually building the projects, putting steel in the ground. We've seen project development, EPC costs increase across the board, which really does eat into, those ITC and PTC tax credits. So look, in short, tax credits really can introduce new inefficiencies into the market. They remove some of the pressure to keep costs low, and that can effectively eat into margins for investors. Obviously, that's a key sensitivity that'll impact how successful the IRA is in spurring new project development. We crunch the numbers on pass-through rates for ERCOT, CAISO, MISO, and PJM. So we found that if you just assume that just 50% of the value of tax credits ends up in the hands of project developers, as opposed to our standard assumption of 90%, that would reduce wind, solar, and battery deployment in those four ISOs by well over 100 gigawatts by 2035. So compared to that more optimistic scenario of a 19% tax rate. So, a pretty big impact. Although I should say that, as you alluded to, not all regions are impacted the same. Certain markets like CAISO and PJM, where there are stringent RPS standards, where there's things like carbon pricing, there's a relatively muted impact. Compare that to somewhere like MISO, you know, there's not a whole lot of domestic policy support. RPS standards tend to be less stringent. Economics of wind and solar or batteries slightly less attractive than a market like ERCOT, at least on average. So tax credits are fairly essential to making the numbers pencil. Lower pass-through rates have the potential to really undermine the business case in markets like MISO.
Very interesting. What is Aurora's outlook for utility-scale solar and wind costs, both on the CapEx as well as OpEx side? Where in the supply chain are you still seeing issues, and what are the key drivers for cost declines going forward?
Yeah, look, I think in general, we're still relatively bullish on cost declines in the long term, especially for something like solar, where there's still a lot of potential for innovation on the technology side, things like new materials, things like perovskites, layering of multiple cells. We see that driving up module efficiency from around 20 to 30% over the next 20 years. And that really helps drive about a 50% decrease in CapEx and a 30% decrease in OpEx between now and 2050. So fairly bullish in the case of solar. For wind, I think the potential for big cost declines is a bit more limited. You know, on the CapEx side, we see around a 30% reduction between now and 2050. That's primarily from better turbine design and manufacturing. On the OpEx side, we see a decrease of around 10%. You know, things like improved monitoring, O&M scheduling. That said, the short term remains challenging, especially in the case of wind. A lot of those cost declines come in the first couple of first few years because costs are so high right now. And I really do think it's going to be another couple of years before we start to see things getting back on track.
And are there somewhere in supply chain specifically where you're still seeing issues, meaning more on the manufacturing side or somewhere else?
Yeah, I think there's the different pieces, right? So first of all, there's higher materials costs, you know, particularly for things like steel that increases the price of turbines. Cost of labor is up across the board. Interest rates are up, which makes it more expensive to take on debt. So all of these things, particularly in the case of wind and like I say, in offshore, we've seen some big projects fall through recently. All of those things make it challenge the environment pretty challenging right now still.
Okay, that's it for this episode of Glenmont Insights. We hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to follow us and subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. A big thank you to our guest, Oliver Kerr, for joining us today. And thank you for listening. Until next time.